From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, MSU's high-speed search for an interim president.
There's just going to be a leadership upheaval in this university right now, and they're going to need a steady hand pretty quickly.
A former MSU sexual assault counselor talks about accusations against student athletes.
This isn't about just Antonio or just Izzo. This is a cultural issue that we're all a part of, and so there's a lot of opportunity going forward to figure out how collectively we want to shape our culture.
The West Michigan company where workers set their own schedules to take time for family.
I would say you're going to have a much happier workforce. It's not so much us against them, it's everybody's working together.
And the Michigan mom who will be sending a message to President Trump. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This is the most challenging time in the history of Michigan State University. As MSU becomes the focus of a cascade of allegations regarding sexual abuse on campus, including accusations against members of the football and basketball team, the school is also on a high-speed search for an interim president following the resignation of Luana K. Simon. Chad Livengood is with Crane's Detroit Business. He's been looking at the possible candidates for interim president. He's with us now via Skype. Chad, universities, they like to be deliberate and like to take their time in searches like this. MSU does not have that luxury, does it?
They do not. I mean, normally these things, so you hire a firm, you help you select candidates and weed through a long list of potential people. You bring people in. It can take, six, seven, eight, 9 months to even contemplate. And they've got to do this in a matter of weeks, really, because the president left. The athletic director retired, but he really resigned, basically. You had the dean of the school that Larry Nassar worked under. He stepped down. There's pressure. One of the trustees is calling for the general counsel of the university to resign as well. I mean, there's just going to be a leadership upheaval in this university right now, and they're going to need a steady hand pretty quickly to both, get the day-to-day operations of the university under control and then deal with the fallout and aftermath of all the different investigations from Attorney General Schuette to the legislature to Congress, and Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, and then all the media scrutiny that's coming in. And there's a lot to handle right now.
This interim president is going to have to hit the ground running. And your piece at Crane's looks at some names being floated right now as possibilities. Let's kind of go through and look at what they might bring, starting with former Governor Jim Blanchard.
Yeah, Governor Blanchard is an MSU grad and close friend of the university's. He donated $1 million to the university just a year ago or so. And so he's available, you might say. He's been a lobbyist for a D.C. law firm for most of his post-gubernatorial career, which, Jim Blanchard has been out of Lansing since 1990. It seems like a long time because it is. And so he's not maybe the front runner, as some people describe it, but he's a potential.
And former Governor John Engler.
Same situation. He obviously unseated Jim Blanchard in 1990 and has experience both running the state and also running some business trade groups. And he's also sort of on the market.
You write about someone who perhaps might not be a household name the way the two former governors are, Mark Murray. Who is he and what's his background?
Well, Mark Murray was actually John Engler's state treasurer and state budget director at one point. He is currently the vice chairman of the Meyer Company and was CEO of Meyer for about 6-7 years. And before that, he was the president of Grand Valley State University. He's really widely respected in the business community, in the higher ed business, and in political circles. He is a Republican, but described as agnostic. And he also worked at Michigan State University many, many years ago as their budget director. That's how he came over to the state of Michigan, which is pretty common. And people switch jobs between East Lansing and Lansing a lot in those administrative type roles. And so he's got the experience of a university president. He's got the experience running a large corporation like Meyer. And he's also got the political cachet, which which whoever is going to take on this job is going to need, because they're going to be faced with, you know, all these investigations from politicians from Lansing to Washington.
Another name you write about, former MSU trustee Kathy Wilbur, and she's now with Central Michigan University?
Yes, Kathy is also a former Engler aide and cabinet secretary and worked in the Engler administration, ran the Commerce Department. She has been at Central Michigan University as their lobbyist since 2002. I've known Kathy for years, having been a student at Central and a journalist there and also a journalist in Lansing. So she is well known. And two things that she and Murray have, that they have advanced degrees, that's kind of a checklist that the Board of Trustees wants to be able to check off, because they don't want to have a fight with the faculty over who has a terminal degree or not. And that might seem petty to some in a case of a crisis right now, but it is an entrance hurdle to higher education administration. And she also was interim president of CMU a couple years ago, 2009-2010, when they were in between presidents. And one of the reasons she didn't get to become the president of CMU was because she didn't have a doctorate degree, and she just recently got one. And she lives in town, too, so it's kind of like someone that people know, but maybe not too chummy. A lot of people say you really need a complete outsider to come in and do house cleaning, and maybe that is the case. But right now, they probably just need somebody just to keep the trains moving and prepare for what is, you know, tens of, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in liability lawsuits from Larry Nassar's victims.
As you talk with board members and others, Chad, did you get a sense of who might be the front runner here?
Well, a couple of board members told me that all four of these names are in the mix and thought about. You get a sense that Murray, if they could get Mark Murray to leave, a pretty good gig at the top of the Meijer grocery store chain company and come over. And he is a graduate of MSU, both bachelor's and master's degrees. So, he seems like to be sort of described as the dream candidate here. But people also think that Kathy Wilbur is just as qualified. I think, you know, even though they're prominent and they've got name recognition, people like former Governor John Engler and Jim Blanchard and even former Governor Jennifer Granholm, they would bring their baggage as politicians. I mean, for lack of better words, Jennifer Granholm already said on Twitter, ruled herself out. But just think about what would happen if the Republican Party has a long narrative about Jennifer Granholm's quote unquote lost decade. And that would just get kind of, added to the mix in the noise surrounding all the fallout from the Nassar scandal. So it's kind of dicey and seen as a non-starter by some board members to bring in a political figure or, a former governor or even former member of Congress. There's been some names thrown around there, too.
Final few seconds. Do we have any idea whether any of the four people you write about in your piece for Crane's Detroit Business might be interested in being MSU's interim president?
Well, none of them called me back last week, which you can take that as a sign of either they don't want to talk to me or they don't want to talk about it yet until maybe they're ruled out. But people close to them, a couple people say there's definitely some interest among all the people in that camp.
Chad Livengood, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
The city of Grand Rapids is widely considered to be a great place to do business, unless you're Black. A 2015 study in Forbes found it was the second worst city in the nation in terms of being economically friendly to African Americans. Well, an organization working to promote entrepreneurship in Grand Rapids has launched a pitch contest meant to encourage startup ideas from everyone, especially those in the minority community. 100 ideas lets anybody pitch their business idea in 100 seconds or less. Budding entrepreneurs with the best ideas win $1,000 to flesh out their plans and advance to a round where they may get more incubation capital. Paul Moore is one of four co-directors of Start Garden, the group doing this pitch competition, and he is with us now via Skype. Start, Paul, by telling us briefly just what Start Garden is.
So Start Garden is an organization that began with really accelerating and investing into tech startups. And then a couple years ago, on a much broader level, started to work on entrepreneurship in Grand Rapids in general, because we were seeing that just by focusing on the tech sector, we were not getting broad participation in entrepreneurship. And we, in fact, the Forbes article was a great wake-up call that there's a lot of work to do across the board. We do a lot of connecting entrepreneurs to resources now, but now it can be a small business, it could be a startup, it can be basically wherever where resources need to exist, we're trying to create them.
So to whom is this competition meant to reach out to?
It's for the entire community, I would say, to each year put down, you know, the ideas that are in your head and get them out there and try to run with them. Now, what we realize is that every single entrepreneur that has an idea uses capital to get the idea to experiment, to get it out into the world. It's just that that capital is almost always bootstrapped or from friends and family. So this is really made for people that don't have access to bootstraps or friends and family, and to put the capital within their reach so that they can use it.
So how will it work? If I'm going to pitch to you for in this 100 ideas competition, what will I be doing?
We made the easiest platform ever, I think, to submit an idea. In fact, I've started to just say, can you tell your phone your idea? Because that's all you're doing at the website. It's a brief video really just explaining the idea. It's not even really a pitch. The formal pitch portion or presentation, I should probably call it, really happens in July. So it's kind of it's almost like a precursor to a competition that happens in July. And the idea is that you seed 100 ideas, and then they come back in July and they essentially make the case for why they should get another $20,000.
That's easy to do. I think, yeah, most of us could probably handle that in the safety of our own home, looking into our phone and making a case for our idea. And you are hoping to reach those in the minority community with this, too.
Definitely. All of our promotion is very much targeting the minority community and communities that have felt like they weren't participating or invited to participate or couldn't participate because, you know, again, they didn't have bootstraps or friends and family that could support, you know, their wild ideas.
Well, start getting creative, folks. Pitches for 100 ideas are due by April 10th of this year, and you can get all the details by going to startgarden.com. Paul Moore, thank you so much for sharing this with us on The Next Idea. We'll be very excited to see kind of where this all takes everyone.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up later, a former Michigan State University sexual assault counselor speaks out about her frustrations with the way the school handled sexual assault cases within the football and basketball programs.
This isn't about just Antonio or just Izzo. This is a cultural issue that we're all a part of. And so there's a lot of opportunity going forward to figure out how collectively we want to shape our culture.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Turning back to coverage of the crisis at Michigan State University, an ESPN report over the weekend reveals a longtime pattern of denial, lack of action, and allegations of incidents involving Spartan football and basketball players. And all of that is resulting in tough questions for coaches Mark D'Antonio and Tom Izzo, such as this moment for Izzo at the post-game press conference yesterday, as he was questioned about why former player and student coach Travis Walton was allowed to stay on the job after being accused of punching a woman in the face, and then followed by a separate accusation of being connected to a gang rape.
We want to give you every opportunity to answer questions. There's a lot of questions. A big one is, why did Travis leave the program in 2010?
I don't know what you mean. He graduated.
He was with your staff throughout 2010. An allegation came forward later that year that from a woman and her family to the athletic department that he and two of your players raped her. He then left the program later that year in 2010. Why?
To be honest with you, I don't remember why he left. I went to Europe to play, and as you know, I'll still say I'll cooperate with any investigation that's made. I did it then, I did it before, and I'm not going to answer any questions that aren't pertaining to either basketball or things that I am not going to talk about right now.
Michigan Radio's sports commentator John Ubacon is here now. And postgame press conferences are not going to be the same for Coach Izzo. What do you think of the way he's handling these questions, as well as Coach D'Antonio's statement Friday night?
Well, D'Antonio's got the advantage of not being in season, so therefore he's more prepared for these, and he was clearly ready for his statement. Coach Izzo, of course, is going to coach two games a week, and after each one of them, you don't know who's going to be waiting for you. And he was not ready, clearly. And he needs to be, because these questions are going to come up, and they should come up, frankly.
Now, the tones that they took with their statements were very, very different. I'm thinking of the Friday night juxtaposition. Did that surprise you?
No, and that will actually serve Izzo better than D'Antonio, in my opinion. D'Antonio is circling the wagons. He's being very defiant. I think D'Antonio is in a much more vulnerable position than Izzo is. Neither one is on rock solid ice. I wouldn't say that. There are serious questions to be answered about serious situations.
What did you not hear in those statements?
Concern for the victims, which you always lead with, of course. Now, Izzo was correct. He has cooperated with all the investigations that I'm aware of.
And Friday night, he did say, I want to be there to be a part of the healing for the survivors.
Which is possible. Now, if you're part of the problem, I don't know if you're part of the healing. That will be determined. Mm-hmm. If they've determined that he has done what has been asked of him, then perhaps he can't be. Now, if that is possible, I will say this with a gigantic qualifier that if that's possible or not, I don't know. We don't know enough right now. But Izzo is the kind of guy who could rally the university behind the whole community in a way that no one else could to a solution, to serious reforms, serious changes. Again, I don't know if that's possible, if he's tainted too much for that or not. We will find out as things move forward. I would make a distinction between Izzo's situation and D'Antonio's. As far as I know, Coach Izzo's got three situations to answer for. One, is, of course, is Travis Walton, the one being discussed. Also, Adrian Payne and Keith Appling were both part of an incident with a woman that looks horrible.
Two alleged incidents.
Exactly.
That we're hearing. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what happened there will be a question worth answering for sure. We don't know about that. In D'Antonio's case, he has a 10-year pattern of 16 players accused of sexual assault over this stretch. I'm not dismissing in any way Izzo's situation, but it seems to be at least contained. Now, how bad that is, we're going to find out. I don't see D'Antonio's as contained. I see it as a pattern that has been rolling out for a decade, class after class. And that, to me, is a different situation. Now, again, that might not save Izzo. Maybe it shouldn't. But I don't see them as quite in the same basket.
And the NCAA says it's coming in to open an investigation at MSU. You have been very consistent over the years, John, about your lack of confidence in the NCAA's ability to hold universities accountable.
Lord help us all. Look, they don't do their own job very well. They're not going to do the FBI's job very well. In the Baylor basketball situation, a player murdered another player. They stayed away. UVA lacrosse, a boyfriend killed his girlfriend, both on the lacrosse teams, and no investigation, which actually I think is correct in this case because the NCAA adjudicates on cream cheese or butter on a bagel doesn't make it a meal. I don't want these people looking into pedophilia, murders, these things. They're utterly ill-equipped to do their own job, let alone this job. Penn State, of course, they got in based on public pressure. Now public pressure is on them to get into Michigan State, so they're going to do it. And they were told of this in 2010, we have since learned. Mark Emmert, of course, the president of the NCAA, was told of this and ignored it. So now he's going to come in on his white horse. I don't buy any of this. However, Joel Ferguson, longtime trustee of Michigan State, brought this on his alma mater by saying they are not competent enough to investigate us. Well, apparently they heard him because 24 hours later they decided that they were, in fact, competent enough. I agree with him. They're not. But you brought it on yourself now, and this is one more mess you're going to deal with. The NCAA is going to make this worse, not better.
I'm thinking about when I read your book, Fourth and Long. You took such deep dives into the athletic programs at four Big Ten schools, including Penn State right after the whole Jerry Sandusky scandal. What has all of this that's been building now in East Lansing say to you about big college sports programs and accountability for student athletes?
We have not learned nearly enough from the Catholic Church scandal, from the Penn State scandal, and now from this one. And that is when somebody tells you about assault, you don't hem and haw, you don't tell them how tough it's going to be for them going forward, you take action. It is the law. It is not only a moral principle, it is the law. And there will be some people here, I think, might be going to jail based on this. And if so, let the chips fall. Because 14 people we know were told about what Dr. Nasser had done to them by the athletes themselves. And little or no action was taken. That's Kim Kozlowski of the Detroit News. Hats off for her for great reporting. So we have learned very little. Two big mistakes can happen from here. One on the Michigan State side is you circle the wagons, you deny, 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 which they've already done. They've blocked a lot of FOIA requests, things like that.
Fighting the civil suit.
Fighting the civil suit. No, you're not here to fight anything. You're here to help the victims, to solve your own problem in your own house. And anything else you're going to do, is going to drag it out, and it's going to make it worse and more expensive, is my guess. That's one mistake. The opposite mistake is on the outside of the media, the public, and so on. The whole burn it all down. They're all corrupt. They're all horrible. No, far from the case. Your daughter went to Michigan State. People I know there have had a uniformly excellent experience. Now, that's not everyone, apparently. We know this now. But the idea of burning it all down is crazy, and don't blame everybody. Cooler heads now need to prevail in the investigation.
Yeah, so how do we make sure coaches like Izzo and D'Antonio get a chance, get the opportunity to answer questions, defend the way they've handled their programs, while also holding them accountable?
You need a proper investigation. Now, on that front, we now have Attorney General Bill Schuette involved. I'm not optimistic. He is running for governor. He's going to watch the political winds. He's already stayed out of this for a very long time. And Gretchen Whitmer is now talking tough, his main opponent, it looks like, from the Democratic side. She was not talking tough when she had a chance to do something about this a few years ago.
Meaning when she was in the Ingham County Prosecutor's
Office. Exactly right. So I have very little faith in either one of them to play anything other than politics with this. You need the FBI. You need somebody, a third party from the outside, to do a serious job on this.
What kind of ripple effect, John, do you think this is going to have in college athletics around the country? Or, better put, should it have?
Two, one good, one bad. The good one, of course, is that guess what? When athletes tell you these things, take action. When your athletes are involved in these things as the perpetrators, take action. Give it over to law enforcement. Don't try to get cute or funny. Don't deal with just campus police. Get serious law enforcement help, and it's someone else's issue at that point. It really is. In terms of it's their investigation, not yours. Second thing it's going to do is tell the bad guys out there how to smother this thing even deeper, to pass the buck, blame the assistant coach, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's already happening, of course, with paying players and whatnot. The head coaches know how to keep their hands off these things. You're going to see more of that cynically in the future.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Michigan has a problem attracting and retaining the talented workforce it needs. It's an argument we have heard from business and political leaders from Governor Snyder on down. Well, one West Michigan company has a remarkable way to keep employees happy, keep them right where they are. Micron Manufacturing of Walker. It's a precision machining supplier, and this company lets workers create their own schedules. You want to be there for your first grader's field trip? Do it. Want to have a long lunch with your aging mom? You certainly can. With us now is General Manager Dan Vermeesch. Dan, how many employees do you have at Micron?
It is a non-union shop. We have 34 men and 6 ladies, and we've been in business since 1952.
And just to be clear, no supervisors and workers figure out their own schedules?
Yeah, we have no mid-level management at all. There was a day where we had supervisors and lead men. And we haven't had a supervisor at Micron since 2003 and a lead person since 2007. So it's been a bunch of years that this has been in the making to get to where we're at today.
So when did this kind of come in officially? This idea comes in, let workers create their own schedules. How long did that take to effect, and how long have you had it in operation?
So we started our lean journey in the year 2000-2001, and from the beginning, our intention was to have the schedules visual and so much of the work so visual that we wouldn't need a supervisor to tell an employee what they had to do every day. So each employee knows what they need to do tomorrow before they leave today. We started that process in 2003. So it took us about 3 years to put together the beginning of the process. And then 4 more years after that to really hone it in to where everybody was able to participate in it. 2007 is when we really had the model put in place. So we've been doing this for about a decade. But I'd say when we hire a person, it is the most difficult thing for new people to get used to, because they're used to being told you got to work from this time till that time and on this day to that day. And so it takes a lot of trial and error on a new person's part and a lot of questions. And it's a part of their training. They tell them, hey, this is when I'm going to be here. It'd be good if you're here so that we can work your training in. And then they kind of get used to whatever their personal schedule is, and we all work around each other.
Yeah, I had to imagine the orientation process could be tough if you're bringing someone in from that traditional work environment.
Yeah, very, very difficult. There's a lot of questions. I'll never forget a few years back. On a Thursday, I went up to a new employee and I said, hey, are you going to be here tomorrow? And he looked at me and goes, you tell me. And I'm like, what? I don't ever tell anybody when to work. And so I said, what does the schedule say you have to do? And he says, well, there's this, this, and this that needs to happen tomorrow. I said, well, I guess you better be here then, right, in order to get it done. He goes, well, it'll only take me a couple hours. I said, well, then just come in for 2 hours.
How do you measure whether a prospective employee could handle this freedom and flexibility?
Well, I don't know that we have a specific metric for that. When we interview, a lot of places say they interview for character. I know for a fact we certainly do. And it comes down to, do we believe we have a responsible person? And any responsible person is going to be able to figure this out and deal with it. And in a hurry, everybody loves it, as you might imagine.
I can only imagine what it was like to be told, well, yeah, do your 2 hours and go home. What is this shift in workplace culture meant to your company, Dan, in terms of attracting and retaining employees?
Oh, retaining employees, it's been huge. We've been told a number of times by employees that it is by far one of the best benefits that we offer because, as you might imagine, you know, with that many guys working here, a lot of folks may have wives that are working in the medical industry or other industries that just can't be as flexible, and it's important to their families that we are able to be that flexible and still take care of our customers. And so when we describe it to potential new employees, I think they think, ah, that sounds good, but I can't believe it really is that way, because every one of them comes in and within a few weeks they're flabbergasted at the flexibility that they have. So I don't know that helps with attraction, because I don't know if anybody really believes it, to be honest. But retention, for sure.
Micron's a small family-owned company. Do you think that this kind of flexibility could work at a bigger company?
I have no doubt that it could. It's really customer-driven. You have to take care of the customer, and everybody here knows that. They know that the day we don't take care of the customer is the day that it ends. So some industries wouldn't lend itself so much. You know, like I said, a medical industry, doctors and nurses, they can't just show up when they want to if they have a patient scheduled for something. And so it won't work maybe for every industry, but any size company that has the ability to have a flexible means of satisfying the customer, it could work anywhere. It, you know, in the beginning, I mean, we stumbled. We had mistakes. We did things wrong. But you got to have confidence that it's the right thing to do with and for the people, and it'll work anywhere.
Dan Vermeesch, General Manager of Micron Manufacturing in West Michigan, where they have no mid-level supervisors and the workers can set their own schedules. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Cindy. I appreciate it.
Let's find out now what it means to be able to create your own work schedule. Dan Schapansky works at Micron Manufacturing. Dan, how long have you been there?
I've been over 30 years now.
What was the work schedule like before you and other employees were allowed to create your own? What would be a typical week?
Oh, way back, we always worked 4:10s to 11. Every Friday was the norm, and then sometimes Saturdays if we got real busy. It was pretty much 6 to 4:30.
And what did you think about when you first heard that this could be coming, that you might be able to decide what your schedule was going to be every day?
I didn't really know what to think about it at first. It sounded like a good opportunity if, you know, you need some time to do something on the personal side. So it was pretty exciting.
And how have you used this flexible scheduling? What might a week look like for you now?
For me, it really benefited. I mean, of course, I've been here 30 years, so I'm 50 now. So when my kids were younger, my wife was working actually at the hospital, and she couldn't have flexible hours at all. I would leave every day at 7:30. Take them, see them off to the bus or drop them off to school, and then I'd come back at 8:30. And I did that for probably 2 to 3 years. That was a huge benefit. I see my mom once a week. I take an hour lunch. So I've been doing that for quite a few years, so I'll just take an hour lunch on Wednesday or Thursday. And now it's gone to third generation. I have my grandson. I sometimes just spend a little extra time and come in late so I can spend some time with him. So.
Yeah.
I've benefited greatly by it.
And how have you seen this policy affect the way you and your coworkers feel about their jobs and about the company, about Micron?
I mean, everyone that's worked here knows that, you know, Micron's about family focus and that flex time. Some people would, in the beginning, would feel bad that they got to leave. They're basically told, why are you here if you had a, you know, personal concern? So I think people are very happy, and it makes it a lot less stressful that you don't have to even really think about it. You know, we have to keep an eye on our schedule, of course, and see where we're at. And we kind of make up hours later in the week if we need to, or do whatever. Everyone loves it. I mean, I would say for sure it's the number one rated perk you get here.
So instead of orders coming, you know, from on high through layers of managers and supervisors, you all are owning this.
Yep, you keep an eye on the schedule. You know what basically the whole week looks like, but what you're going to be doing, and everybody can see what everyone else is doing. So then if you have to leave, you just go up to someone and say, can you fill in for me for this day or this few hours? And there's no big surprises. So it works out well.
What would you say, Dan, to people who are top executives at other companies going, wow, could this really work? What would you say to those executives who might be wondering, could this work at my company?
I would say you're going to have a much happier workforce. It's not so much us against them. It's everybody's working together. And when it really boils down to it, certain emergency things are much more important than work. Everyone knows that. You don't have to walk away. No one's feeling bad about anything. And it just makes for a more pleasant work environment by far.
Dan Schapansky, who is an employee at Micron Manufacturing of Walker, where he and his coworkers can set their own schedules. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dan.
No problem. Thank you.
Up next, the Michigan mom sending a message to President Trump at his upcoming State of the Union address.
I want him to realize that I am a person, I am an American citizen, and so are my children, and he's tearing us apart.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When President Trump gives his State of the Union speech tomorrow night, the wife of a man the Trump administration deported will be sitting right there in the chamber. Cindy Garcia is the guest of Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. Dingell has been working to reunite Jorge Garcia with his family. He was deported to Mexico 2 weeks ago. Both Cindy and her husband Jorge spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
Tell us about Jorge. How long did your husband live in the United States?
He came to the United States when he was 10 years old, and he's 39 as of right now. He just had a birthday January 2nd.
And how long have you two been married?
We've been married for 15 years.
I understand that at one point you tried to obtain legal status for Jorge. Why didn't that happen?
At that time in 2005, when we tried to adjust his status, the lawyer was incompetent, and she put in the wrong information on the sheet of paper that she turned in. So we automatically had a hearing in front of the immigration judge. At that time, the judge was asking us questions, and our answers did not coincide with what was written on the sheet of paper. I showed him the copy that I had and said, you see how it doesn't match? We crossed the things off, and we told her to redo the application, and she did not. He was upset. He said, well, I will get back to you in writing with my decision. I think it was a month later, he told us that my husband had 90 days that he had to leave the country. At that time, within the UAW, Michigan United and LACLA supported me, and we got a stay of deportation for 1 year. Following year, we had to reapply for another stay of deportation. And from 2011 until now, when DACA was available, he fell 1 year short, so he did not qualify at that time. So we were waiting for the new DACA to come around that had no age limit or some type of new law that he could apply for.
What did immigration agents tell you was the reason your husband was being deported?
When we went on November 20th, immigration had told us that under the new Trump administration, his time had come about, and that because he already had a deportation, he would have to leave.
So he didn't commit a crime at some time in his life or anything like that?
No, nothing at all was on his record.
You have two children together, a 15-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old son. How have they been coping with their father being forced out of the country?
My children are devastated. As you can see on the video, when my husband was being torn from us, my youngest child was just in a state of shock. Even now, sometimes he's in a state of shock. He doesn't want to cry. And then when we do get him to cry, it's hard. So we have to hug him and we have to watch him, especially. My daughter lets loose at night. We hug each other. I tell him that we have to take this tragedy as a blessing and move forward in our lives. And we have to be the voice for the other families that are out there that cannot come out of the shadows and speak. And I said, we all have to be there for each other. And I tell my husband also, do not get depressed, do not get down and out. We are still continuing the fight. We will bring you back. It's just the time. Just give us time.
How have you been doing?
Same way. I can get depressed at times, but I know that that's not going to solve my problem and that I have to be strong. And I'm glad God gives me the strength to go out and speak on my family and the other families that are living in the shadows. And I have to think about it as I'm telling somebody else's story and not my own, because otherwise I just fall out and tear down, and I can't do that. I have to be strong.
What do you think deporting your husband, your kid's father, accomplishes for the country?
I think what it showed to the country is that no one here is protected, that it doesn't matter if you commit a crime or you don't commit a crime, everybody is being deported. And that is not right, because the president himself said only criminals are going back. So if that's what he's saying, why is he hurting our economic status here in the state of Michigan, and why is he separating families?
By attending the State of the Union address, what message are you trying to send to President Trump?
I want him to see what he is doing to my family. I want him to be able to put a face to the tragedy that is going on. And I don't know if he will feel any compassion at all, but I want him to realize that I am a person, I am an American citizen, and so are my children, and he's tearing us apart.
What's next for you and your family?
We're going to try to bring him back. We're going to sit with our lawyer and start the paperwork with the waiver so we can have a hearing down at the American Embassy in Mexico and see what our outcome is, because there can be a ban placed upon him, either 3, 5, 7, or 10, and that will be our next fight if they don't let him come back.
Cindy Garcia is the wife of Jorge Garcia, who was taken from his family and deported to Mexico. Mrs. Garcia will be the guest of Congresswoman Debbie Dingell attending President Trump's State of the Union address. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
We've got Jorge Garcia on the phone. He now lives with his aunt near Mexico City. I got to tell you, the cell phone reception is a little spotty. The quality is not great. But Jorge, how's it been living away from your family?
It's been really hard. And until now, it's like, I don't know what to think, because everything's different here. So it's been kind of rough.
Jorge, Cindy tells me that she's telling everybody to be strong. She's being strong, too. Can you tell us how you feel about what's going on, and are you able to keep up the strength that Cindy's talking about?
I've been trying to stay as strong as I can, but like I said, even though I can talk to her and almost every day, depending on how much signal I get, it's kind of hard, because basically I feel like I'm by myself and, you know, being somewhere where I don't know anybody, it's hard.
Do you have any connections of any kind or any work prospects or anything that keeps you busy?
No, not yet. So I still got to get some of my paperwork that I need here. Some of the stuff that they ask for when you go and ask basically to look for a job, they ask you for certain kind of papers. And that's one of the things that I got to start working on.
Jorge, how do you feel about Cindy being at the State of the Union address?
Well, I feel really good. I think that, like you said, she's really strong. And, I mean, she's the one that's sending a message out there. Hopefully, I mean, with all the stuff that's going on, probably something good comes out of it, you know. And all the stuff that she's been doing, she's a strong fighter.
Well, Jorge, thanks for talking with us. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Jorge Garcia. His wife, Cindy, will be the guest of Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell at Tuesday night's State of the Union. Michigan State University was all over ESPN's airwaves this past weekend. The cable network's investigation, details of which started coming out late last week, directed a spotlight at the Spartan football and basketball programs. The reporting included allegations of crimes against women committed through the years by student athletes. And it detailed how the university handled accusations of sexual assault against the players differently than for the rest of the student population. ESPN reporters described former MSU sexual assault counselor Lauren Alsweed as a key source in this investigation. After 7 years, Alsweed said she left MSU in 2015 out of frustration with the way that sexual assault cases were being handled there. Stateside's executive producer Joe Lindstroth met up with Lauren Alsweed in Lansing yesterday, and he got her thoughts on just what unfolded over the weekend. He first asked her about MSU football coach Mark D'Antonio's defiant response to what was in the ESPN report.
He said, "Any accusations of my handling any complaints of sexual assault individually are completely false." Now, he was responding directly to an instance that you shared with ESPN regarding a football player who was accused of sexual assault 7 years ago. Can you share that story with us?
What I was told about his response came from the general counsel at MSU. I trust the general counsel that any information she told me about what D'Antonio was doing was well-founded, and she told me for a reason. So I had every reason to believe her when she told me how D'Antonio responded to the player who was accused of sexual assault.
And who was?
Christine Zako.
And what did she describe?
She came to my office early one morning trying to reassure me about all the things that MSU was doing to respond to specific cases that were brought up in the OCR investigation. And to reassure
the Department of Education,
correct.
Office of Civil Rights Investigation.
Yep. And then to reassure me more broadly about how much the administration cares, how much the athletic department cares about sexual violence, all the actions that they're taking on campus to address it. And that's when she told me, as an example, about the proactive effort D'Antonio was making by having his player speak to his mom about an alleged assault.
D'Antonio's response was pretty defiant. He said he's always done things by the book, notified authorities when dealing with cases of sexual assault.
I think by the book and on paper, there's a lot of T's that get crossed and I's that get dotted. It's more about what is happening behind the scenes that I think is important to address too. What's the tone that's set even before an incident is reported? And not just are they responding once something happens, but are people having conversations to prevent it in the first place? Or, you know, beyond just a training at the beginning of the year, every year, do they talk about sexual assault and sexual harassment throughout the entire year and at different times and in different places?
At any time when you were with the sexual assault program at MSU, did you work with administrators in the athletic department? Did you do trainings? Did you consult on trainings for student athletes?
We tried to work with the athletic department a lot of times, and there were people who did come in and provide training, I think maybe with the Women's Resource Center or other organizations, so it wasn't just with athletic department trainers. Part of the problem was that there were a lot of conversations that the sexual assault program was not allowed to be a part of. So these weekly meetings on campus to discuss any report of sexual assault that happened over the past week, the sexual assault program was not allowed to attend those meetings where Residence Life or General Counsel or Title IX investigators were all present talking about what the university was doing to respond to sexual assault. And then the people who were working with the victims in the, you know, in the sexual assault program weren't at the table, weren't having the conversation.
Why? Did you have conversations in trying to get a seat at that table?
We did. We wanted to be a part of it. We pushed to be a part of it. There was a claim that that would create a conflict of interest because we knew people, we were working with people directly, and so any confidentiality that we had with the victims would be challenged, and we wouldn't allow to share information we argued that we would be able to share information more broadly about patterns or trends or experiences, but we still weren't allowed at those meetings.
I want to move on to basketball coach Tom Izzo. He said he's not retiring, and he wants to be a part of the healing process for the survivors as well as the campus community. How do you think Tom Izzo can be most helpful?
I think he has one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, voice on campus. He said on Friday that he wants to help, but he doesn't know how to help or what to do to help. And that there's still some uncertainty about what he could do after all of this time is telling to me, because there should probably be a more comprehensive plan of action at this point after everything has happened. And that he still doesn't know how he wants to help is significant.
I want to get your sense of how reports of sexual assault were handled in the legal system in Ingham County. About how often would the students and other women who came to you for sexual assault counseling end up filing police reports, would you say?
So most of the people I worked with did not want to file a report either with the police or the university. The people who did end up filing reports, there was a long investigation a lot of times with the police, or charges were ultimately not issued. There's a very low prosecution rate in Ingham County, which is another important dimension of this problem that shouldn't be overlooked. This is not just about the athletic department or about MSU, but about a larger system. We should be looking at the prosecutor's office and different police agencies and their response and their investigation of violent crimes.
And how many cases that you were involved in were perpetrators ever convicted of sexual assault, of criminal sexual conduct?
There was one MSU student that I worked with in the 7 years that I was there whose case was prosecuted in a trial and resulted in a conviction. There were some other people I worked with, Lansing residents, whose case was prosecuted, I think two or three, maybe, that were prosecuted and also resulted in a guilty conviction.
So a handful? Two.
A handful. Over 7 years.
What do you want to see next?
That this is an issue that's not just about the athletic department. This isn't about just Antonio or just Izzo. This is a cultural issue that we're all a part of. And so there's a lot of opportunity going forward to figure out how collectively we want to shape our culture and what role we want to take and who should have a prominent voice and who should help lead things going forward.
Where does that start?
Well, it starts with everybody. And I know a lot of the information coming out is divisive at times, and people are defensive because people they have admired or esteemed are being challenged and attacked. And so I know there's a lot of emotion involved, understandably. If there's also a willingness to maintain some open-mindedness and objectivity, we could have a much more productive conversation about what the problem is and what the solution then should be.
ESPN reporters called you their, quote, key source. You've been on national television all weekend. What's been the response?
Most of the response has been really positive, and the most important part for me has been from the survivors I work with or from people reaching out for the very first time who feel supported and emboldened and cared for the very first time. There are some people, of course, who aren't as positive about what's been happening, and there's a lot of fear that's been a part of this conversation, and so there's a lot of anger about the blame some people are being given and a lot of defensiveness and perhaps justification.
I understand that you also heard from someone involved in the Jerry Sandusky scandal at Penn State University.
That was really surprising to me. A woman named Vicky Trapone contacted me, and she had been really involved at Penn State when the news broke there about everything that was happening with Jerry Sandusky and Joe Paterno. And she wanted to express her support for me as someone who'd been through something similar, and just if I needed anything to let her know. And that made me realize that I was part of a very small but very special club, too, of people who are willing to come forward and say something, not knowing entirely what they're getting into, but having the support of people once they get there and feel overwhelmed maybe by the attention and the criticism. So I was very glad that she reached out for me.
Lauren Allsweet is a former sexual assault counselor at Michigan State University from 2008 to 2015. Lauren, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
One quick clarification. Allsweet referred to Christine Zacho as MSU's general counsel. She misspoke. Zacho is MSU's deputy general counsel. And we offered Zacho a chance to respond. We did not hear back from her. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scon. That's our program for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.